What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israel is being accused of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza as Israeli forces continue to severely restrict the delivery of humanitarian aid, food and medical supplies to millions inside the besieged territory after 4 months of indiscriminate bombardment and mass displacement. UN human rights experts warn Gaza's 2.3 million population is facing severe levels of hunger, with the risk of famine increasing daily. For more, we're joined by Alex Duval, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. His piece for The Guardian is headlined, "Unless Israel Changes Course, It Could Be Legally Culpable for Mass Starvation." Alex Duval, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out the argument you have in your Guardian piece.
So my argument is essentially that while it may be possible to bomb a hospital by accident, it is not possible to create a famine by accident. And that for some months now, and particularly in mid-December, when the Famine Review Committee, which is the sort of the highest level of humanitarian assessment in the world, an independent, impartial, professional, and extremely discreet body of experts, said that Gaza is heading towards famine. It is already in catastrophe. And these are very technical terms. And unless there is an end to active hostilities by the Israeli authorities and army, and a full spectrum of relief operations, it is inevitable that sometime in the coming months, and they said in early February, under the technical definitions, Gaza would be in famine. So that is fair warning. And the actions undertaken by the government of Israel, and the war crime of starvation is defined thus: using starvation of civilians as a method of warfare by depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies. So the main element of the crime is destroying foodstuffs, hospitals, medical care, sanitation, shelter, etc. Unless that is all stopped, Gaza will be in famine.
And Alex, if you could clarify, we just have a minute. You say that Palestinian children in Gaza will die in the thousands, even if the barriers to aid are lifted today. Explain.
So a humanitarian crisis is like a speeding freight train. Even if the driver puts on the brakes as hard as he or she possibly can, it will take many miles for that train to come to a stop. So the levels of malnutrition that we are now seeing, the exposure to infectious disease through polluted water, through overcrowding, and through lack of shelter, will mean that this humanitarian crisis continues. So this is not something that can be stopped overnight. And the and the fact that even after these warnings were issued, even after the International Court of Justice issued its provisional measures instructing Israel that it had to undertake these key actions, that this has continued and the United States has not stopped it, makes them culpable for the crimes of starvation.
So, Alex Duval, if you could speak, you've worked obviously on the question of famine and of mass starvation in many other contexts. If you could put what's happening in Gaza in the broader context of what you've witnessed from Sudan to Ethiopia, Afghanistan and Yemen.
I think the key element, key fact about what is happening in Gaza, has been happening for the last few months, is an exceptionally accelerated and concentrated and clearly deliberate, intentional reduction of a population to a state of outright starvation. Of a nature that we have not seen in modern times. There is no parallel to this since World War II. So if we compare what is happening in Gaza to the other great famines in recent times, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Yemen, in the Nigerian civil war in the 1960s, in China, late 1950s, many of those were much bigger in terms of the numbers of people who died, because they impacted much larger populations. They were also much slower. They took many, many months or several years usually to unfold. They all have in common the fact that it is political or military decision that not only sets in motion starvation, but allows it to proceed without being halted. But this is an extraordinarily ruthless and concentrated example, as I said, without real parallel since World War II.
And could you explain why its intention doesn't really come into this, why it doesn't matter whether Israel is deliberately using starvation as a weapon of war or if it's a byproduct of its assault on Gaza? Why is that not relevant?
So let's look at the case that was presented to the International Court of Justice by South Africa recently. And that used the Genocide Convention. And the key provision in the Genocide Convention is Article 2C, which is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Now, the court is going to take a long time to rule as to whether this is genocide or not, because the key element that it has to determine is genocidal intent. Now, there are a lot of senior government ministers in Israel who've made blatantly genocidal statements, but that does not in itself prove that there is genocidal intent in the way that the Israeli Defense Forces are conducting their operations. But the actual facts on the ground are that conditions of life that will bring about the physical destruction of a significant part of the population of Gaza, those are there. Those are actually existing, regardless of what is the intention. And there are different types of intention. So the war crime of starvation, which is the focus is on depriving civilians of objects indispensable to survival, which isn't just food, it's anything that is indispensable to survival. That can be deliberately intended in the sense that the criminal, the perpetrator, wants to starve, or obliquely intended in that the perpetrator is conducting the action for another reason, like crushing a military adversary, but it has that outcome. Now, the key thing about starvation is that it doesn't stop just because you stop doing your action. And it continues when you are being warned. And if you continue doing it, even though you are warned of the outcome, you are also responsible. And that is the key here. The key is that Israel is knowingly creating these conditions because it has been warned and warned repeatedly, and yet it has continued. And so that makes it culpable. And regardless of the intent, the crime is being committed. And those who are arming Israel, supporting Israel, and undermining the relief capacity, which is particularly the UNRWA, are complicit in this.
Well, another point that you make in your Guardian piece, I'll just read a short sentence. You write, "Never before Gaza have today's humanitarian professionals seen such a high proportion of the population descend so rapidly towards catastrophe," you say. "And this as residents in the north, northern Gaza, are reportedly eating grass and drinking polluted water. UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, said today a food convoy expected to move into northern Gaza was targeted by Israeli forces." So, Alex, if you could talk about that, and of course, this coming as there are your warning of famine, these are the conditions on the ground, and donor countries are considering defunding UNRWA.
So the if we go back to what the Famine Relief Committee came up with back in December, and this was based on the data that they gathered primarily during the humanitarian truce at the end of November, they have a 5-point scale of food stress, going from phase one, which is normal, phase two, which is stressed, phase three, crisis, phase four, emergency. And in emergency, this is when children start to die in significant numbers. And phase five, which is catastrophe or famine, depending on exactly how the different metrics and indicators work out. And the current, as of early December, was 17% in catastrophe phase five, 42% in emergency phase four. The projected, which was for this week, early February, was 26% in catastrophe or famine, and 53% in emergency. So three-quarters of the population in emergency or catastrophe or famine. And that is quite extraordinary, given that right at the beginning of the crisis, the population was under stress, but the rates of severe acute malnutrition were actually pretty low. The number of children who suffered from wasting because of deprivation of food was about 1% or thereabouts. So it's just to reiterate, this train of catastrophe is moving extremely fast. Now, there is a principle that was adopted by international humanitarians and by the United States government some 12, 13 years ago in Somalia, which is broadly called no regrets programming, which is that if you see a catastrophe unfolding, you must set aside the strict criteria in two regards. First of all, how closely and clearly do you actually know how bad it is? You should operate on a worst-case assumption. It's better to waste some resources by feeding people who may not actually be starving to death. And secondly, you also need to work with authorities, or you have to have a humanitarian carve-out that means you can work alongside or with authorities that you don't fully trust, knowing that some of your aid may be diverted. In the case of Somalia in 2011, it was the terrorist group Al-Shabaab, because unless you worked with them, there was going to be a famine in the areas they controlled. And so it was agreed we will have a humanitarian carve-out. Now, this no regrets principle is being inverted today in Gaza, in that the slightest suspicion that some members of UNRWA, which is the only capable relief organization able to deliver assistance at scale, the slightest suspicion that some of them, small number, are associated with Hamas and its actions is leading to a potential major cutoff in funding. And that makes international donors doubly complicit in what is going on.
You also wrote in your piece, just to put what's happening in a comparative frame, you wrote, quote, many wars are starvation crime scenes in Sudan and South Sudan. It's widespread looting by marauding militia. In Ethiopia's Tigray region, farms, factories, schools and hospitals were vandalized and burned, far in excess of any military logic. In Yemen, most of the country was put under starvation blockade. In Syria, the regime besieged cities, demanding they surrender or starve. The level of destruction of hospitals, water systems, and housing in Gaza, as well as restrictions on trade, employment, and aid, surpasses any of these cases, you write in your Guardian piece. So if you could elaborate on that.
So, what the Israeli Defense Forces are doing is not the full range of starvation crimes. For example, we don't see them pillaging, we don't see them stealing en masse. But what we do see is this relentless destruction of essential infrastructure. And this goes far beyond any proportionality. The laws of war are very clear that if you are conducting a war in an area that is inhabited by civilians, that you have to have the damage to civilians, the deaths of civilians, must be proportionate to your military objectives. And even the Israeli former Chief Justice Aharon Barak actually has said in a judgment, actually relating in this case to torture, that a law-abiding state or a democracy must, and I quote, must sometimes fight with one hand tied behind its back. Because the fact that there are combatants embedded within a civilian population does not mean that that civilian population loses its civilian character, its protected character, according to the war. And what we're seeing in the case of Gaza is that the Israelis are essentially treating the entire population as a combatant population. That is de facto what we are seeing. And we did not see that, you know, with this intensity in any of these other cases.
And Alex, if you could put this all in the context of ongoing U.S. support for Israel and also U.K. support, but principally U.S. support, to the extent that Israel is guilty of creating the conditions for famine and already inducing mass starvation in Gaza, is the U.S. also complicit?
I think morally, clearly, it's complicit, and it could be legally liable in two ways. One, first of all, would be if the International Court of Justice does indeed find that Israel was is responsible for genocide, and then the United States could be complicit in that crime, in certainly the element of inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. But even if the ICJ doesn't find that, or it takes a long time to find that, the International Criminal Court prosecutor is also looking into war crimes and crimes against humanity, which have essentially the same provision without the genocidal intent. And I think this would not be difficult to prove, that the same outcome is being is occurring with the just the intent to destroy these things without the direct intent to cause starvation or to cause genocide. So starvation being the predictable outcome. Now, if the prosecutor of the ICC were to begin to issue arrest warrants for Israeli officers or commanders or politicians, then the U.S. might find itself, by implication, complicit on those grounds, too. So the U.S. lawyers need to be very, very attentive to that as they give the administration its advice on whether it should continue in its current policy, which, as your correspondents have been saying, appears to be unconditional support for Israel.
We reported in our headlines that Belgium summoned the Israeli ambassador after Israel bombed Belgium's development agency in northern Gaza. The bombing reportedly occurred on Wednesday after Belgium announced it would not pause funding for UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees. So, Alex de Waal, could you respond to this? And if a direct link is established, though I'm not sure how that would be, what does it mean that Israel is carrying out this kind of retaliation against a humanitarian agency?
That would be just an extraordinary violation, not only of international humanitarian law, but of international criminal law. And if it could be proven, it would mean that the those responsible could and should end up in court on trial for those crimes.
Alex de Waal, now we want to turn to, you know, you've done a lot of work in Sudan. So if you could talk about, you recently wrote a piece for Chatham House on the situation now in Sudan. If you could elaborate on that,
Well, let me actually take a little step back, because what we're seeing in the Horn of Africa and in Yemen is something that we have not in my almost 40-year career of studying food crises in these countries, we have not seen before, which is four major simultaneous food emergencies unfolding at the same time. So we have in Sudan, we have about half the population. It's a country of about 45 million people, and about half the population is in need of emergency assistance because of the war. In Ethiopia, we are seeing in the northern part of the country a rapid descent into famine conditions. They're not yet there, but they are heading there due to a combination of the effects of the war in northern Ethiopia, which unfolded over 2 years, came to an end a year ago, combined with drought. In Somalia, the continuing insecurity and conflict combined with severe drought and now, in recent months, severe floods related to climate change. And in Yemen, the impact of the protracted war and siege, which just came to an end last year, which is now being exacerbated by the hostilities between the U.S. And the Houthis and the designation of the Houthis as a terrorist organization. We're seeing four massive food crises unfolding in parallel at a time when two other things are happening. One is that the price of food aid has shot up because of the Black Sea crisis and also the Red Sea crisis. It's just the cost of shipping, the cost of insurance, getting food to these countries has gone up. And also the budget of the major agencies, such as the World Food Program, has been massively squeezed. And that's primarily because there is a standard allocation from the U.S., the major donor. But then what we what the World Food Program and what USAID need is a supplemental allocation, and the supplementary budget is held up in Congress.
Thank you so much, Alex de Waal, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and the author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. His new piece for The Guardian is titled Unless Israel Changes Course, It Could Be Legally Culpable for Mass Starvation. To see part one of our conversation with Alex de Waal, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
The liberals paused funding to UNRWA, which is a lifeline for millions of innocent Palestinians.
They don't believe in international rules when it doesn't suit them.
From the government to the media, Canadians continue to drop the ball in the wake of the ICJ's ruling on South Africa's case against Israel that Israel is committing a genocide. The ICJ came out last week, as they broke down in the video last week, that it is plausible that there is a genocide in Gaza being committed by Israel. Now, again, I go into the reason around the framing and the phrasing, and there's a reason why they just say plausible. It's because the ICJ doesn't take longer or doesn't take shorter than a year to investigate anything. So it's going to be a while to get a full investigation, but based on all the evidence, it is clear what Israel is committing in Gaza. And despite that, the reactions we are seeing are just incredible. So I'm going to get to some video from a response by a progressive group to Justin Trudeau. They recently canceled, this is a Muslim group, recently canceled a meeting with Trudeau because of his inability to recognize reality. And I'll get to some other clips as well to give you some more context. I first want to start with this. This showcases an issue with at least some of the media in Canada. And this isn't, you know, universal, of course. A lot of the reporting that I rely on is from Canadians. But reports like this are just so absolutely ridiculous. This is a piece put out by the Toronto Star. The writer here is saying, my piece from yesterday's return, how do you sleep at night, bro, quote unquote, Parliament returns with the same old toxic behavior. This was an article discussing how, these members of Parliament are being very rude. There's a lack of decorum in Parliament. That was the focus, just how people are rude to each other. That was a quote about Gaza. So Matthew Green of the NDP tweeting out here, how do you sleep at night, bro? Yeah, I said it. What's missing here, though, is the context of the minister's decision to cut critical funding to UNRWA, despite the ICJ interim orders to provide humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza experiencing plausible genocide. Instead of a focus on how this is a massive problem, the Toronto Star, at least this writer in the Toronto Star, decided to focus on decorum. This shows a serious level of disconnect, not only to what's important, but also the fact that voters want their politicians to care. Showing emotion, calling out somebody and you know, with some real passion and anger because they're not recognizing a genocide is the correct thing to do if you are a human that feels. If you just want a bunch of robots in Parliament that don't feel anything, then we've already had that for years. If you want people to actually care about issues, care about people, care about human rights, there's going to be occasional outbursts of emotion, feelings. But no, you can't do that in Parliament. That's the big issue with Parliament, is decorum. Not the fact that nothing's getting done about a genocide. Absolutely insane. Now, let's get to Canada's position after the ICJ ruling. Global News reporting here, and this is how a lot of outlets reported it, Canada takes no clear position on the ICJ interim ruling. Taking no position on the ruling inherently means you are taking a position to defend Israel. Because the ruling was against Israel. The ruling showcased that there is a plausible genocide taking place in Gaza being committed by the Israeli government. Taking no clear position on that, on those facts, on the actual ruling, means you are defending Israel. So there is a clear position. Canada continues to defend Israel despite the ICJ showcasing a plausible genocide in Gaza. That would be the actual headline if this outlet and others actually cared about the facts. But let's get to the actual statement. So this is the statement put out by the Government of Canada, Minister Joly, writing here, quote, Canada supports the ICJ's critical role in the peaceful settlement of disputes and its work in upholding the international rules-based order. Quote, our support for the ICJ does not mean that we accept the premise of the case brought by South Africa. It is for the ICJ to make a final decision on the case, which it has not done today, which they never do. Again, it takes them often years to come to a final conclusion, but the interim ruling showcases that, yes, there is a plausible genocide taking place. Canada will continue to support Israel's right to exist and defend itself in accordance with international law, which, I don't have a tab here on the death toll again, but if you go and check it out, we're talking over 25,000 civilians in Gaza killed by the Israeli government. The number from Hamas is still the same number from October 7th, meaning Israel has continued to bombard a tiny strip of land which they already controlled again and again and again for months, killing over 25,000 civilians, mostly women and children. And this is the reaction? Defend themselves? The second part of this. Nothing can justify Hamas's brutal attacks on October 7th. I want to show you look at the difference in tone here. Nothing can justify Hamas's brutal attacks on October 7th. Canada remains deeply concerned about the scale of humanitarian crisis in Gaza. So Israel is not even mentioned here. Nothing can justify Hamas's brutal attacks on October 7th. Okay. Yes. Fine. Canada remains deeply concerned about the scale of humanitarian crisis in Gaza. A crisis being committed by who? Who is committing that crisis? The ongoing and serious impacts on Palestinian civilians. Why is it not mentioned here that Israel is committing the crisis? Shouldn't Canada be deeply concerned that Israel about the amount of scale of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza being committed by Israel? But no mention at all. And not even to, like, again, brutal attacks versus, oh, we are deeply concerned about the scale of crisis. And then this one is just the cherry on top. Stop using Palestinian civilians as human shields. This is, I don't know how many times this has to be debunked. This idea, let's take it to the extreme. Let's pretend that, yes, Hamas is using human shields. That's why there's all these civilian deaths, 25,000 people dead because of they're all human shields. Let's put it in the context of, since there's a lack of a better, you know, analogy here, let's pretend the mafia. So I know it's not a great example, but let's pretend the mafia takes over a school in Toronto. To get the mafia, do you then bomb the entire school? Oh, well, the mafia was using human shields. We had to get them, so we had to bomb the entire building to get the mafia. We have never done this. I mean, Americans, a bit of American history, they have done something like that in the past. But in recent times, this is not, it's not anything that is acceptable. Yet, this is perfectly fine for the Israeli government to do. It's perfectly fine for them to, because they want to get Hamas, it's perfectly fine for them to kill civilians in the process. When is this ever okay? When do we ever lay waste to entire cities to get some bad guys? Unless it's overseas, of course. But this is not the kind of justification that makes sense in any way. Yet it is the line that keeps being touted out. And as you can see, I'm kind of losing it here because it is ongoing fucking bullshit. Every fucking day, this bullshit is being laid in front of us and we are expected to eat this garbage. There's a greater breakdown here from Canadian Dimension on just how ridiculous that statement is from the government. There are a number of puzzling features, as they say. Canada is subject to the court's jurisdiction. So them saying, quote, our support does not mean that we accept the premise of the case brought by South Africa is already bizarre because Canada is already subject to that court. And they say here, only possible reason for including this quote here is to cast doubt on the validity of the interim ICJ verdict, which, of course, that's why they wrote this here. We don't accept the premise of the case, but you're a part of the court. What, you agree to international order. Yet, for some reason, this case specifically, you don't accept the premise of. What does that even mean? It completely disregards, it's a desire to completely disregard whatever evidence comes forward in the case because you don't accept the premise of the case to begin with. The whole point of bringing an entire case forward is to showcase why the premise of the case that Israel's committing genocide, why the premise makes sense. If you're not willing to even accept the premise, then you are shutting your eyes to the actual facts in the case. Going on to right here. While the statement affirms, quote, Israel's right to exist and defend itself within international law, nothing in the ICJ ruling questions this. Jolie is dragging us away from the court's sole concern, which is whether or not Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Great points made here. I'm not going to keep expanding because I'll lose my fucking mind. Nothing can justify Hamas's brutal attack on October 7th, as they write in the statement. This was irrelevant to the ICJ ruling since it was Israel, not Hamas, that was on trial. Again, showcasing here the distraction mechanism that the government of Canada is trying to institute in their statement. And most importantly, Jolie's statement does not even mention the provisional measures mandated by the court. So it completely ignores what the court actually says. Yet Canada is very concerned about upholding international order. You know, but before I even get to the response here from the National Council of Canadian Muslims about the meeting with Trudeau, I want to show you this clip here. This is the South African foreign minister discussing this idea of international law and how some countries think it doesn't always apply to them.
You know, I think this notion of international rules is very comfortable for some people to use when it suits them, but they don't believe in international rules when it doesn't suit them, because they don't apply international rules or law equally in all circumstances. So you can't say, because Ukraine has been invaded, that suddenly sovereignty is important, but it was never important for Palestine. Mm-hmm. It's very peculiar. Mm-hmm. If you believe in international law truly, mm-hmm. then wherever sovereignty is infringed, it must apply. Mm-hmm. And this is the point we've been making, that we use the framework of international law unequally, depending on who is affected. And we are arguing that that must change.
I got to say, it is very refreshing to see political leaders on the international stage actually care about international law. Because we don't have that in Canada. We don't have that in the US. We don't have that in the UK. So thank God there are countries like South Africa that are willing to bring a case like this to the ICJ and try to uphold some actual international order. Because Lord knows we're not seeing it in the West. Now, I want to get to this clip from Stephen Brown. This is the CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, and his recent comments following Canada's non-response to the ICJ's ruling.
We, representing the vast majority of the Canadian Muslim leadership from coast to coast, have officially canceled our meeting with the Prime Minister. At this moment, we no longer think it's productive to speak with this Prime Minister. As community leaders, we will continue to engage elected officials across the country. This is an unprecedented step for us. We've always engaged with our government and in our democratic process, and always agreed to meet and engage precisely because this Prime Minister came to us with great promise and did deliver on select things that Canadians had asked for, to reverse a dark time of division after 2015. However, that great promise now feels broken and perhaps beyond repair. As we stand here today, our government has consistently noted that it believes in multilateral institutions like the United Nations and the International Criminal Court of Justice. Yet that hasn't stopped Canada from refusing to take any accountability in responding to the provisional measures and ignoring international law by refusing to take seriously any of what the ICJ ordered as provisional measures. Instead, they've compromised the integrity of the international rule-based order and the ICJ by challenging the premise of the case.
So I'm going to get to a second clip from Brown here in a second, but this is a big deal. This group, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, was a big supporter of Justin Trudeau, especially coming out of the Conservative government's, you know, reign for 10 years. And at the time, look, a lot of us were very happy to get rid of Stephen Harper and the Conservative government and move to something else. And there was reason to have hope and promise. And there have been, of course, some changes. But seeing what Canada is doing right now, the government of Canada, and seeing this unwillingness to accept the results that the ICJ concluded, this unwillingness to just see reality, see what your ally in the far right-wing Israeli government is doing to Palestinians, to not be willing to accept any of that, how can you separate them from the conservatives? Like, there are some differences, and there is a little more debate within the Liberal caucus over this than there is with conservatives. But when the leadership, when the Prime Minister is unwilling to uphold international order? This is the kind of thing that would throw people, that would create, you know, an uprising in media, in, I would assume, the opposition party, which would probably be the Liberal government. If the if a conservative government was denying the results of an international body like the ICJ, then we would rightfully be freaking out. Yet here the Liberal government is doing it. And in doing so, they are losing people, even like this group here, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, despite the long support they've had for him and the party. Let me get to the second clip.
Over the last 3 months, we've heard our government offer justification and cover for the killing of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza. We've watched as they stood quietly by while journalists were targeted and killed. We've seen members of this government justify the targeting of hospitals and schools where thousands have been taken shelter. We've seen the feminist foreign policy Canada so proudly speaks about becoming silent in the face of women and girls who've been slaughtered by the thousands. We've seen the government that stood strongly in support of the Afghan girls, the right of Afghan girls to go to school, forget that children in Gaza deserve the same right to an education too. There's almost no mosque left in Canada where there is not any congregant who hasn't lost a member of their family in Gaza. The Prime Minister yet has not specifically condemned any attack on any mosque or Muslim person in Canada in the last few months, despite us repeatedly raising those attacks with the Prime Minister's office.
The lack of response from Justin Trudeau on this is shameful. And I hope he understands that this will be his legacy. It's clear now who's on the right and wrong side of this issue, but it's going to become even more mainstream in 10, 20, 30 years. And we're going to look back at this time and look at all the failures in leadership, be it Joe Biden, be it Justin Trudeau, and what they were doing during this genocide. Now, in contrast, I'm going to show you a good politician, someone that actually cares. Here is Heather McPherson, and here are her recent comments on the funding that was cut to UNRWA, and check out her reaction.
Same day that the ICJ ruled that there is a risk of genocide in Gaza, the Liberals paused funding to UNRWA, which is a lifeline for millions of innocent Palestinians. People will lose their lives. And unbelievably, the Conservative leader has accused 30,000 UNRWA humanitarian workers of being terrorists. He does not deserve to lead. We support an investigation into the 12 former staff, but defunding UNRWA is collective punishment and it is illegal. When will the Liberals stop abandoning Palestinians?
The Honourable Minister for International Development.
My colleague for that important question. These allegations are extremely disturbing and we take them very seriously. We've communicated that to the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini. What we're doing, which is the prudent thing to do, is to pause funding while this investigation is ongoing.
They've paused funding over about a dozen out of 30,000 employees. A dozen that may have, according to Israel, been connected to Hamas. A dozen out of 30,000 employees. Because of that, they've paused all funding to an incredibly important group that supports Palestinians that are living in Gaza, that is delivering help to them, civilians. Yet, over 25,000 in Gaza killed by the far right-wing Israeli government. And the support and funding and kind words continues for Israel. This response here from Independent Jewish Voices to Heather McPherson, which, by the way, in case it wasn't clear, she's an NDP MP. The NDP right now, the only party that appears to care about Palestinians, the only major party. I'm not certain where the Greens are on this. They've been kind of back and forth depending on who's in power. But NDP is fairly solid right now on this issue specifically. But Independent Jewish Voices reacting here, saying thank you to MP McPherson for stating the truth that cutting UNRWA funding is a form of collective punishment and abandonment of human beings in extreme need. And it's going to end on this. This is Amnesty International coming out after the ICJ ruling, saying Canada must not sit quietly on the sidelines after ICJ genocide ruling on Gaza. One of many human rights groups that have been consistent here, consistent in all human rights abuses, regardless of the country, whether it's, you know, Russia committing them, whether it's Israel committing them. You see Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, many others, B'Tselem in Israel, a human rights organization criticizing their own government. It's very clear where you should stand on this, based on the facts, based on what we're seeing, based on the ICJ's own ruling. To see whether it's media, whether it's political leaders deny reality, continues to be one of the most frustrating things imaginable. And the only way to possibly change this is to continue putting information out there. It's the best I can do. But to put pressure on your political leaders to ensure that they understand how important this issue is.
Has threatened to, quote, decisively respond to any U.S. attack on Iran following President Joe Biden's linking of Tehran to the drone attack on Sunday that killed 3 U.S. soldiers and wounded 40 at a military base in Jordan. President Biden announced Tuesday he had decided how to respond to the drone attack, though he did not say what that response would be. Outside the White House, Biden responded to a reporter's question on whether he holds Iran responsible for the deaths of the 3 U.S. soldiers.
I do hold them responsible in the sense that they're supplying the weapons to the people who did it. I don't think we need a wider war in the Middle East. That's not what I'm looking for.
Iran has denied any involvement in the attack, which targeted Tower 22, a secret U.S. base in northeastern Jordan near the Syrian border. Responsibility for the strike was claimed by the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, a term used to describe a loose coalition of militias that oppose U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, a U.S. Navy destroyer in the Gulf of Aden shot down an anti-ship cruise missile on Tuesday launched by the Houthis in Yemen, the latest attack targeting U.S. forces in the region. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's authored 3 books on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with a particular focus on Iran and Israel. Trita, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what took place at this remote base, the killing of the 3 U.S. soldiers, injuring of about 40 others, and the drumbeat by Republicans, as well as Democrats, as well as the media in the United States, for President Biden to militarily respond, what would this mean?
It obviously depends on how Biden responds. If Biden is thinking about responding in terms of attacking Iran on Iranian soil, then as the warning came from Tehran, it's very, very likely that there will be a forceful response by the Iranians, which will bring the United States right into a shooting war with the Iranians, which is something that the administration says that they have been seeking to avoid. They have been repeating that message several times in the last couple of days. I think it is important to note that all of this was predicted. From the very beginning, it was clear, as long as there was no material pressure on Israel to cease its bombardment in Gaza, this eventually would lead to a situation in which the United States would be faced with an attack that actually had left Americans killed. If you take a look at the statistics, there were about 60 attacks by these Iraqi militias against U.S. troops and bases during the first 2.5 years of Biden's presidency. Since October 17th, however, when Israel went into Gaza, there's been more than 160 attacks just in these last 100 days. At some point, one of those attacks was going to kill Americans. And the president essentially accepted this risk, continued to allow Israel to bombard Gaza, in his own words, indiscriminately, knowing very well that the game of statistics was simply such that at some point the Iraqi militias would succeed and Americans would die. Now we are in that situation. Instead of raising questions about this entire strategy as to why we are putting U.S. troops at risk in order for Israel to continue to indiscriminately bomb and kill and slaughter people in Gaza, instead, there's been this frenzy about pushing us further into war. And this is how these endless wars begin. Tactical responses to attacks by the other side that in the moment may come across as legitimate because, of course, these attacks against U.S. troops are unacceptable, without any recognition, however, that this is leading us into a war whose aims we have not defined, whose exits we cannot envision.
But, Trito, when you say that these are legitimate questions of attacks on U.S. troops, but what the heck are U.S. troops continuing to do in be in these countries? This Tower 22, for instance, the U.S. troops in Syria clearly have no authorization from Congress to be there. And importantly, in Iraq, the Iraqi government has been calling for the United States to withdraw the few troops it still has in Iraq from the country. But the U.S. is not disposed to even listen to the government of the country in which its troops are located.
You're absolutely right. These are the moments where these questions should be asked, which is, why are we there in the first place? As you noted, the troops in Syria do not have any legal authorization to be there by the U.S. Congress. The troops in Iraq, you know, for such a long time, we've said that they should be pulled out. Nothing has happened yet. And the essential pretext for keeping them there, which is to fight ISIS, has long expired. Because ISIS has been weakened, it's not been completely eliminated, but these countries who have far greater stake in the defeat of ISIS are now capable of handling that on their own without direct U.S. involvement and certainly direct U.S. presence in that fight. So we have to really ask ourselves, why do we continue to have a broader policy in the Middle East in which we are positioning more than 50,000 American troops in various places in the region right now, in which they're essentially made to be sitting ducks and tripwires, and a single attack against them can lead to several deaths, which then again immediately will cause the rise of these calls for a broader war in the region. This is to the detriment of our own interests.
And this whole issue of blaming Iran as the directly responsible for these attacks, every time we hear of one of these resistance groups, it's always with the adjective the Iran-backed or the Iran-financed group. Is it your sense that these groups have their own independent life, or is the Biden administration correct in ascribing all of the real motivation coming from Iran?
I think there's two exaggerated narratives here. One is the Iranian one, in which they're essentially claiming that they have no control over these groups at all and that they're completely independent. That is not true. But also the other narrative, the Washington narrative, is not true, one that claims that the Iranians completely control these different groups and that they have no agency of their own. Clearly, they do have agency of their own. On numerous occasions, they have acted against the expressed wishes of the Iranians, particularly in the case of the Houthis. And even in the case of these Iraqi militias, what has happened just in the last 48 hours is that clearly there's been a lot of backdoor diplomacy between the Iranians and the United States. And now the Iraqi militias have come out and said that they're ceasing their attacks on the U.S. troops at this point. And it's clear that the Iranians have put some pressure on them to essentially de-escalate. I would suspect that the option that the president is considering right now is to do some form of attack inside of Iraq or Syria, probably give the other side ample heads up in order to evacuate those specific buildings. Nevertheless, be able to say that he has responded, make sure that it's not too damaging, but sufficiently strong to be able to calm some of the voices in Washington, but then leave it at that and ensure that there's some de-escalation afterwards. In the short run, that may work, and it might not be a bad plan. In the longer run, however, as long as there is no ceasefire in Gaza, it is really difficult to foresee that these attacks against U.S. troops will end indefinitely. As long as there's no ceasefire, I suspect that they will resume at some point, which means then that a continued warfare in Gaza by the Israelis is a direct threat to U.S. national interests because of the manner that it puts U.S. troops at risk in the region.
Trita Parsi, your colleague at Quincy, Bill Hartung, wrote on X, quote, on the question of Iran's role in the deaths of three U.S. servicemen, President Biden said, I do hold them responsible in the sense that they're supplying the weapons to the people who did it. Does he feel the same way about the 26,000 deaths caused by U.S. weapons in Gaza? Bill Hartung asked. Your response, Trita.
Well, I think Bill is absolutely correct. And I think whether we agree or not with that argument, we have to recognize that is the sentiment throughout the Middle East right now and probably throughout the larger part of the world. In which the United States is held responsible for what Israel is doing, not just because providing all of these weapons, more than 10,000 tons of weapons have been shipped since October 7th. President has bypassed Congress twice to get them to Israel even faster, but also because of the very active effort by the Biden administration to block a ceasefire that has twice happened in the Security Council. That means that the large part of the world do see the United States as directly responsible for this. And that, again, is a very severe to the very severe detriment of U.S. interests itself and the U.S.'s global standing.
Trita Parsi, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
TD and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, five special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Ferreira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte.
And this is Venus Radio at CKUT 90.3 FM, or you can also tune in on our website,